And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Dean Haglund got a great email again from Maurice Terenzio, who writes almost every week now, and we're glad that he does.
Good for him.
And he didn't write actually to the show. He wrote to me because he thought I might be interested, especially in the wake of our conversation last week about John Wick and my comparing it to Buster Keaton. Right, because the Buster Keaton clips at the beginning. He sent me links to a couple of Buster Keaton short films that he thought perhaps I didn't know about. But in fact, of course, not only did I know about one, but I'd seen it because you hipped me to it and have talked about it on this show. And
fantastic.
It's the 1965 Railroader that was a short subject produced by the National Film Board of Canada, travelogue to celebrate, what was it, 100 years of Canadian Railway?
Yeah, it was the Canadian, 1967. Or, the Canadian Railway. But I thought it was also the celebration of Canada from 1867 to 1967. There was a lot of, at the time, 100-year anniversary parties going on.
Well, it's listed as 1965, the film.
Oh,
and but of course I'd seen it because you told me how great it was when we were talking about Keaton years ago. You said that it was like a really, really good work, and
to me, it's some of his best work actually, because there's also a documentary of the making of that. And you can hear him discussing gag construction with the director in terms of how it's got to be shot, what's the visual, and what's the payoff. And this is a guy whose life in vaudeville and in silent movies is paying off. You could see instantly in the documentary his craft of how every shot, you know, where the camera. It was really fascinating, actually.
Well, you beat me to the punch, and you beat Maurice Terenzio to the punch, because this was what I wanted to ask you about. Because in this email, he said that while Keaton was making this somewhat improvisational short subject, the NFB had a second camera crew working, documenting the shoot. And so from this 25-minute color short subject comes a 55-minute black-and-white documentary released under the title Buster Keaton Rides Again, and sure enough, you know all about it.
I'm sorry if I'm a Buster Keaton nerd.
No, but and how great that that documentary gets finished and released just the year before Keaton's death, capturing one last time his brilliance and his craft.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of biographies about him that sort of paint a melancholy picture of perhaps some bouts of alcoholism and dismay with some of the studios, particularly when they started demanding scripts, and his improvisational nature of shooting. Most famously, the avalanche scene at the end of The Bride, where the avalanche of rocks came from a rather dismal test audience screening where there weren't many laughs, except for a few giggles when a couple rocks were chasing him as he tripped down a mountainside or a hillside. And so they went back and shot a super exaggerated bunch of rocks and styrofoam rocks chasing after him and him dodging all that. And he said it was weird. Once they put that in the movie, even though it's at the end, the movie got laughs all the way through from the beginning. Even that it was the same shots from the test audience in the first half that did get laughs because you knew this hilarious avalanche scene was coming. Somehow it got laughs all the way through the movie. So there's all sorts of interesting things to be learned about editing, test audiences, how to construct a gag if you just study your Buster Keaton.
Well, it also speaks to maybe something they didn't talk about, but we do, which is how you market and how you start to talk about a film is really important sometimes in that it might give an audience permission to laugh. I find it so important when I go to film festivals with a film where I want people to laugh to be funny before the screening, to get them laughing so that they realize, oh, okay, all right. You'll remember when we first test screened The Truth Is Out There in San Leandro, and I was freaking out because nobody was laughing. And I thought this was funny. I thought there were some really funny bits in this. I thought this was equal parts conspiracy, consciousness, and comedy. And it was pointed out, well, don't worry about it. They're silent as church mice. You could hear a pin drop in here. So they're riveted. They're paying rapt attention. But it made me realize that, yeah, they were being almost reverential towards the film. And that was appreciated, but we certainly want people to feel free to have a good time with the movie. And sometimes an audience needs permission to do that. And so in this instance, like knowing the scene you're describing with the rocks was coming might have given them permission to relax enough to go, hey, this is funny.
Yeah, right. And go, oh, yeah, that's a funny thing, I guess, as opposed to if you know nothing about it or are anticipating something else. You know, it's like watching BoJack Horseman on Netflix. I am not laughing at it anymore, even though they're funny pictures. If you're just listening to the dialogue, particularly this season with his daughter that is trying to find her way and he's not helping, seeing his family life, good Lord, it's a dark, dark series all of a sudden, particularly if you're just listening to the dialogue and not looking at the animation and the artwork. Woo.
Well, I always thought it sounded dark. Honestly, I still have not watched any of it. It seemed dark from the get-go. And now...
Yeah. But it was dark with this sense of irony. But now it's just... once you get into the family stuff, like it was like the, you know, a dark melancholy of Hollywood. But now it's the family issues. And man, bleak as all get out, that thing.
Wow. Okay, well, I will share these links to both Buster Keaton shorts, the 25-minute Railroad short and the 55-minute black and white behind the scenes, which is fascinating. And I will share those links in the description of this show there at chillpackhollywood.com. Yeah.
It's been a couple years since I've seen it. Maybe I should reward myself.
Why not? Why not? I mean, especially the documentary, it seems, you know, it's always fascinating to go back to see the behind the scenes when it does offer such a glimpse into a genius who also is a master of craft. And I say that because genius and craft are not necessarily, as we've talked about before, don't necessarily go hand in hand, right? I mean...
True.
To be touched by genius does not mean that one is built with the internal drive to work as hard as it takes to truly master a craft. But Keaton was one of those people, obviously, blessed and cursed with both qualities.
Exactly. Your strength is your weakness.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Another filmmaker who has been certainly hailed at times as a genius and other times as a master of craft, an Oscar-winning director, finds himself the subject of the first Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week in, what, months? It's been months since we've had a Lawsuit of the Week, and this has been waiting on the front porch of the show for so long for us to get to.
And nobody stole it.
I think this came down around December 7th. It was released. It broke. The news of this lawsuit broke. And it involves Warren Beatty. And it is, to me, a truly, truly depressing and dark lawsuit.
I don't know this one.
Warren Beatty, whose most recent movie, perhaps the last movie he'll ever make, Rules Lower. Don't Apply.
Oh, yeah. Rules Don't Apply.
Right. Which we both saw, didn't we? And we both enjoyed.
Kind of enjoyed it.
It had things wrong with it, but it also had some things that were really right about it. Was I don't know if you could really say a biopic of Howard Hughes, but it was about a chapter, I think, in Howard Hughes' life, right?
Yeah.
And
his little quirks, like he ate TV dinner. He liked a lot of that stuff, you know, the sort of details in there about his life that were fresh and revealing.
Well, Warren Beatty as Howard Hughes eating TV dinner. Boy, you make it seem thrilling. And then there's a 55-minute black and white documentary about him eating TV dinner.
Oh, my gosh. And how he chose it really so specifically.
The distributor, Regency Entertainment.
Yeah, big deal.
The primary financier of Beatty's Rules Don't Apply is suing the filmmaker for breach of contract, claiming he and others have not repaid the prints and advertising losses, the P&A losses, as they are known, still known as P&A losses, even though most films don't have prints anymore, right? It's just like how we still call this a podcast, with all apologies to Mark Kershon. We still call this a podcast, not a soundcast, even though the technology of making it, nobody's listening to it on an iPod, right? So
You can't even buy one of those anymore.
Anyway, so it's still called P&A, but that's, people, what it stands for, prints and advertising. The amount of money it spends, it costs to not
market.
Finish the movie, but to market and release the movie.
Right.
And apparently, according to the deal, if it did not recoup the prints and advertising costs, never mind the cost of making the movie, but if it did not recoup the prints and advertising costs, the filmmakers were on the hook for the losses.
Good Lord.
And
who would sign that deal?
Apparently, this is, I'm going to just throw words together that really should never go, but it's less uncommon than you would think from what I'm reading. And it just makes me so depressed. It makes me so depressed that any filmmakers would have to sign a deal where they're on the hook for the prints and advertising. I mean, this business has always been rigged, and maybe every business has always been rigged to favor distributors, to favor, right?
Yeah.
If you're in the distribution side of things, that's where all the money is. But now, like the filmmakers, you don't even have to worry anymore about just, will you see any money? Will the investors see any money? Now, if the distributors don't make their money back, you're on the hook for that. Everything rides on the shoulders, therefore, of the talent, apparently. So he and his partners are being sued by Regency. I'm not saying that it isn't an accurate reflection of what those contracts were.
Right.
But it's...
Then I have... that if that's in a contract, then the artist should get final approval on the marketing campaign. And if I were to call, rules of engagement or rules of the game, I mean.
Rules don't apply. Rules don't apply.
Yeah, rules don't apply. A, okay, so if I didn't see much in the way of advertising in that, and the stuff I did see did not make it clear that this was about Howard Hughes at all.
No.
And so...
And you would think that someone then would have walked Warren Beatty. It's been so long since he made a movie. And you would think someone would walk Warren Beatty through the necessary steps of getting out and selling and marketing and advertising a film in 2016. And he did not.
Especially if he's on the hook.
Yeah, especially if he's on the hook for it. And
this seems problematic at the best.
And one of the saddest things of all, it only made $3.7 million at the global box office. And again, as we were saying, the marketing was terrible. Who would want to see it? Worst poster of all time. And the film cost $31.1 million. So a huge flop. But $31.1 million and the damages Regency is seeking are $18 million, which means that the prints and advertising costs were $18 million. Out of the $31.1 million. So Warren Beatty managed to prove that he's not the profligate spender that he has often been made out to be, and indeed showed what a crafty, clever, and resourceful filmmaker he is by making that movie for only $13 million.
Yeah. That's considered a low-budget film these days.
Yeah, so...
And that thing looked great.
So, and yet, no good deed will go unpunished. So, by all means, make Warren Beatty spend the remainder of his days in court fighting because a distributor lost money. But I guess that might distract him from naming the wrong Best Picture winner last year. So maybe that's the good side.
Was that his fault, really?
I think there's enough blame to go around, don't you?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I blame typesetters, you know.
You know who I blame? You know who I blame? I blame the Academy voters who were stupid enough to nominate a terrible movie like La La Land in the first place. That
really
terrible, dreadful movie doesn't get nominated, then we don't have that problem.
What? How cold is your cold heart that you can't have a love story where they're dancing and singing?
You know what would be hilarious, and maybe I really should cut this together, is
what's that?
A montage of us talking about that movie over the years. Because the first time I brought it up, you were shocked, and I said, yeah, this is actually pretty good. This is pretty good, this movie. And I was championing the movie. And
I remember.
The reason I was championing it was, all its flaws aside, I wanted an original musical to do well so that we might get some more original musicals. Knowing that, look, it's not up to snuff of other musicals, and even other musicals that are so rarely made, but that are made,
right,
that are based on pre-existing properties. And
right,
because if people don't get the chance to make original musicals, how are they going to get good at making original musicals, right?
Right.
You know,
we get Pitch Perfect 1 through 3.
It's like, I guess, a certain cinematic affirmative action, right? But
okay.
I remember when there were the first late 90s, we're talking about like 97, there were the first independent films made by Asian American filmmakers. Yellow, right, and Better Luck Tomorrow, I think. There was also Shopping for Fangs. At this time, there were several. Generation X is what they were called, these filmmakers. And I remember thinking that it was important that reviewers grade on a curve. That, you know, these filmmakers did not receive the same kind of mentorship that filmmakers of other colors in this country would get. And right. they did not get the same encouragement from family, friends, peers that others would get because there were no role models for them to point to and say this is a viable career path. So so they really had to, and now Asian American filmmakers with their success, they're standing on the shoulders of those people who you know paved that path for them. And
yeah.
So I feel the same way almost like now with the attempt to bring back the original musical, you got to grade on a curve. You have to. And the originality right. of it has to count for something. Does it have to get you a Best Picture nomination? No, that was horribly undeserved.
Right. But like The Shape of Water is pointing the way, I believe the Mexican magical realism movement is totally in line for musical theater, or not musical theater, but musical movie musicals that were at best, if you look at the Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, were magical realism. I mean, there is a blend of past and future that I think Guillermo del Toro totally sees, and hopefully go that way less than La La Land.
And less than Shape of Water, because, again, as yes. we talked about, and I think you're alluding to the scenes where the movie did come to life, and those were scenes where he was stretching himself, right? And the complacency yeah. that we talked about when we discussed that film comes in with the stuff that he knows too well, that he's too confident Absolutely. In, and those scenes kind of fall flat. I think it's one of the reasons also why, like, Richard Jenkins' scenes in Shape of Water come off so well, because there was the unexpected in those scenes that only an actor of the depth of Richard Jenkins, but also of the constant fear of Richard Jenkins could bring. Richard Jenkins has talked about this in interviews. He is always, no matter how long he's worked, he always has panic attacks, and he leaves every shoot terrified that he will not work again, almost to the point of depression, because he's convinced wow. that he's not giving people enough. And
interesting.
And isn't that exactly the kind of vulnerability, especially in a movie like Shape of Water with this character that he's playing, isn't that exactly yeah. the vulnerability that brought those scenes that he's into life? I mean, think about the pie shop, yeah. for example. I mean, how heartbreaking are those scenes? And
totally.
And I'm not sure they would read that way. I think that's an actor bringing it to life. And that's not to discount Guillermo del Toro's work in those scenes, because as a director, you're trying to create that environment where that kind of magic can take place. But it's about vulnerability. I like that you brought up, though, this this element of these the magical realism, you know, and combining that with the musical, because it reminded me that one of the French films that I thought he was ripping off in Shape of Water, because I mentioned Amelie and City yeah. of Lost Children, Holy Motors, which was my top film of the year a few years back, there are shots and moments and scenes right out of that movie, too, including
right?
the magical realistic use of some musical numbers. So, yeah. That's a movie, by the way, Holy Motors. If that's available streaming on Netflix, Dean Haglund,
why am I not watching it right now?
Stop talking to me and go watch it right now. I will wait.
Oh, my God.
I will hold the call.
Well, my Netflix down under is a little different than your Netflix above the equator. I'm just saying.
Are we speaking in euphemisms again?
No. I mean, there's a... internationally, Netflix looks different than it does on North American soil. That's all I'm saying.
Anyway, we will follow up as I learn more about the Warren Beatty lawsuit. But I sure think it would be a sad day, you know, for filmmakers and also for those of us who you know.
And it's doesn't Regency, what do they really need? $18 million, don't they write that off? Isn't there insurance?
If they don't, if they need it, shame on them, right? I mean, they may very well need it. I mean, as we know, we've gotten to the point over these last several decades where all these major media corporations seem to be hanging by a thread, and I think it's because long ago the bottom line stopped being the bottom line, right? You've pointed out so many times that we don't even care about whether the movie makes money. The movie is a loss leader for the product locomotive.
Right.
Well, we're going to keep making a TV series that loses us so much money because it has a big audience. Well, wait a minute. There's something wrong with that. Isn't there, if it has a big audience and it's losing money? Yeah, but who cares? Because we're able to advertise our other shows during it.
Exactly. Right. So it's the platform of which we launch everything else.
But if you're taking something popular and not making money with it, I don't, in the name of hell, understand how you expect to make money off something that's not popular. So
yeah, that's counterintuitive, I believe, is the counterintuitive marketing. Yeah.
So clearly, film distribution is changing the business. I'm just speaking in platitudes now. The business is changing. Yeah. Technology has changed everything. Changing. All right, we will update people.
The Chilpack Hollywood explanation of the week.
Oh, I got to tell you, I got to share a story with you about a quick follow-up story about Fuzz Aldrin. My beloved feline, because I told you, I think at the beginning of our top 10 show, about how the things that we were really worried about was even as Fuzz was regaining strength and her organs were recovering, she wasn't showing great mobility or agility, had the wobbles, very shaky. And it was feared that this could be long lasting, that it could be neurological impairment as a result of what she'd been through. And the other thing that, of course, is troubling is that it had been more than a month still without Fuzz eating food on her own.
Solid food.
Yeah, being fed through a tube. And that can't last forever. Right?
No.
I don't demand much from my pets, Dean. You know this. You know you let me take care of your Dobermans. You were kind enough to do that, and I don't demand anything from them other than they be dogs. And I don't demand anything from Fuzz other than she be a cat. But I do at some point expect that the definition of a cat be that you eat on your own and you have mobility.
Right. Those are two.
Yeah, I think those are life quality of life issues to pay attention to. Well, as I mentioned on last week's show, Lily has taken to drawing sketches of Fuzz while watching her and tending to her. And one night she drew a sketch of Fuzz leaping up onto furniture. And the very next morning in real life, Fuzz leapt up onto the couch for the first time. Well,
right.
So I told you this story. Well, that night,
yes,
Lily drew a sketch of Fuzz eating food. And next day, Fuzz ate a whole meal on her own and has eaten every meal on her own ever since. Four meals a day. Now, she's eating out of Lily's hand, literally eating out of Lily's hand, has eaten a little bit off plate, but Lily seems to, they both seem to really enjoy the ritual right now of, you know, little bits over an hour, but full meals end up being ingested this way. So it's so cute to see. Obviously, it's required me to learn how to use utensils and a plate since Lily's hands are unavailable, but isn't that amazing? Wait, isn't that amazing?
And I know. So this means Lily has the shining.
Well,
the picture drawing shining.
She has always wondered. Lily has always wondered how I seem to be able to communicate with Fuzz. I can get Fuzz to do certain things. I can know what Fuzz is doing. We have a certain communication, and my communication with Fuzz is all about visual images.
Of course.
I think there's two things at play here. As I've mentioned to you before, I think, right, one of the best things about having a cat is they induct you into a creative energy, but also they love being around a creative energy because,
right,
as brainwave patterns have revealed, the brainwave pattern of a human being engaged in a creative activity is almost identical to the normal brainwave pattern of a cat. And our nervous systems, it turns out, are, you know, almost identical. So so I think there is something to do with that. It makes a cat feel very comfortable to be in that energy. So it's healing.
Oh.
It's healing to be around creativity, something that maybe people who are recovering from things ought to think about, right? Maybe it's not
right.
about putting on a television show to distract yourself from the pain or whatever. Maybe being around a creative endeavor and that energy will be healing and recuperative. But the other thing is, I also think that through the process of sketching this, Lily had a very workable image in her mind that could relay to Fuzz.
Visualize.
Yeah, that Fuzz could catch on to go, oh, right, eating. I remember eating. Because she literally had seemed to lose that instinct altogether.
Interesting. So that by you manifesting the image onto a three-dimensional piece of paper, then that could translate into Fuzz then going, oh yeah, right.
Well,
that's
I'm gonna say
I should emulate.
I'm gonna say more that maybe for Lily, the process, it required her to be drawing it to hold that image. Because when I've communicated with Fuzz, it's through visual images just held in the mind. But I can hold it.
Right.
I can meditate right. on that visual image.
Like a movie still.
Yeah. So.
Fascinating.
And what is unseen is no different than what is seen.
So
I don't know.
Now you're going to draw a picture of Fuzz with $1 million. That's the next.
Yeah, it's going to be a drawing of Fuzz paying her own medical bills
with the credit card in your mouth.
I want to swiping the credit card. I want to make up actually Team Fuzz T-shirts and sell them to help offset some of the costs. Wouldn't that be cool?
Of course, out of context. Yeah. Out of context, it'll be a little weird, but, you know.
A picture of Fuzz and Team Fuzz on it, and...
Oh, yeah, with a picture of Fuzz. That'd be good.
And then we have a little additional little badge, Team Captain, for her doctor, for the head of the ER staff there at the hospital. That would be, that'd be cool.
That's fun.
Celebrity deaths.
In the last week, Dean, there have been 16... in the last 7 days, there have been 16 major celebrities, and we're not going to talk about any of them because we have so many dating back to December that I want to talk about.
Good Lord.
So
okay.
let's remember some of these people, especially because they're interesting. If I didn't think they were interesting, I would say good riddance. No.
No, that's terrible.
That is terrible, and so I would not do that. How about legendary astronaut John Young, who walked on the moon and later commanded the first space shuttle flight? He has died at age 87. Did you hear about his death?
I did not.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I like this actually now, because that guy's a big deal.
Yeah, for sure.
He was.
And did not hear a thing about it.
He was one of NASA's true pioneers. He was the only astronaut to go into space, get this, as part of the Gemini, Apollo, and Space Shuttle programs. And he was the first to fly into space on 6 different occasions. He was the 9th man to walk on the moon, number 9 with a bullet.
yeah.
He became commander of Apollo 16. And his blast-off tally ended up being a 7. Seven times he went into space altogether, which for decades was a world record.
Of course. He
flew twice during the two-man Gemini missions of the 1960s, twice to the moon during the Apollo program, and then twice more aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia in the 1980s. His NASA career lasted 42 years, longer than other astronaut, and he was revered among his peers for his dogged dedication to keeping the crews safe and his outspokenness in challenging the space agency's status quo that risked that safety.
Oh.
Yeah. He was, you know, because he was there for that 1967 Apollo launch pad fire that killed three astronauts, including Gus Grissom, Young spoke up. He was the one that really spoke up after the 86 Shuttle Challenger disaster. And it was his scrutiny that continued well past Columbia's disintegration during reentry in 2003. He was still working, and he was holding people's feet to the fire for the safety failures on those.
Right. As opposed to shrugging your shoulders going, well, space travel is dangerous.
Yeah. So,
that's the thing now. There's parachutes in all of the, on every seat in the space shuttle after the 86 disaster, because it was revealed if there was parachutes, some of those pilots, astronauts could have survived that explosion.
A funny story about him. He and the aforementioned astronaut Gus Grissom, they made the first manned Gemini mission in 1965, and unknown to NASA, Young smuggled a corned beef sandwich on board.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and
wouldn't that have been a contaminant?
Well, yeah, I think you'll like this. It was given to him by Mercury astronaut Wally Schirra, and when it came time to test, and these tests were being recorded, of course, when it came time to test NASA's official space food, because realize that this is the first of that group to go into space.
Right.
So they're up there, and one of their things is to test NASA's official space food. Instead, Young handed Grissom the sandwich as a joke. And the scandal that ensued was enormous. Two silly minutes of an otherwise triumphant five-hour flight just overshadowed everything. NASA brass and Congress considered the entire mission a multi-million-dollar embarrassment and outlawed the astronauts bringing their own food ever again.
Outlawed. Yeah. Made a law.
Certainly a policy, yeah.
Okay. Still, I mean, we all drank Tang. You know what those space ice cream styrofoam blocks are? Those are terrible. The hell, I would have taken a corned beef sandwich, too.
He earned an aeronautical engineering degree from Georgia Institute of Technology in 1952, went on to join the Navy and serve in Korea as a gunnery officer, eventually became a Navy fighter pilot and test pilot. This is all before being an astronaut for 42 years. He received more than 100 major accolades in his lifetime, including the prestigious Congressional Space Medal of Honor in 1981. And even after leaving NASA, he worked to keep the program alive, noting in his official NASA biography that he was continuing to advocate the development of technologies, quote, that will allow us to live and work on the moon and Mars. These technologies over the long or short haul will save civilization on Earth, he warned in his NASA bio, almost as a parting shot. So again, how that was not big, big news, the death of this man, is really, really just, it's a shameful reminder of where we're at in terms of our news cycles, I think.
Well, I think I heard the one page or the one line was astronaut who smuggled corned beef sandwich dies.
What'll it be?
I was going to fill up with whatever's cheapest.
I'll be happy to take care of that for you.
I thought this was self-serve.
We're completely full service here at Empire State Gas. Sure, it may cost you a bit more, but you're worth it. Now, what else can I get you? Something from the snack shop for you and the little lady?
There is no little lady. I'm alone. And I just ate.
Well, how about a complimentary balloon animal for the kids?
I have no kids, and I'm still alone.
Well, don't feel bad. You may be alone, but you're wise enough to come to the largest independently owned gas station chain in the Northeast United States.
We're in Los Angeles.
I'm sure that you know that our gas is organically grown and good for the environment.
Good for the environment?
That's right. When you burn our fuel, you're actually helping to reverse climate change. That's why we say at Empire State Gas, from farm to pump, we've got great gas.
We are already enjoying a lovely conversation with the pioneer of soundcasting. Brandon.
Who called us the grandfather of. No, the godfathers of
podfathers.
No, no, your podcast royalty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're podcast royalty.
Wait a minute.
That's right.
Wait a minute. Yeah. So I love that. Wait a minute. You named us podcast royalty while at the same time trying to kill off the name podcast.
The term.
I had to distance myself as fast as possible.
Okay, listen. We got ahead of ourselves. Welcome back to the show, corporate branding's very own Mark Hirshon.
Hey, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
It is.
Now,
let's
start with the bad news, Mark. Succotash, your regular, ongoing comedy podcast.
About comedy.
Yeah, it's a comedy podcast. Or soundcast.
If you
God bless.
Soundcast podcast.
Yeah, comedy podcast soundcast. Ooh, see, if you had thought of that, you wouldn't have ended the show.
Man.
You've ended Succotash. Why?
It is ending. It is ending. I've had my final episode, and yet I still have one more final episode left to drop.
Wow. What brought this on?
Well, you know, I thought about it for a long time, and I've you know, Succotash has been going not nearly as long as you guys, but it's been going for 7 years.
Wow.
And when I started it, at the time, there weren't a whole lot of people listening to this medium. There were like 15% of Americans had heard of podcasting, but even of that 15%, most of those people hadn't actually heard a podcast.
Right.
And in the intervening 7 years, because I said, I'm going to get in this thing, and my format is to play, for the most part in the beginning, just clips of other people's comedy soundcasts, including Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Right.
And I said, I am going to spread the good word of podcasting. And I feel I've done that. And now it's huge. There's like 40% of Americans have heard, downloaded, and regularly listened to these things.
Yeah.
And I said, I think my job here is done.
Mission accomplished.
Maybe I should have you join the Breakfast Club, Mark, because that other 60% that doesn't listen to podcasts or haven't heard of podcasts, those are members of the Breakfast Club. So these are the people that I need help with. I mean, I do, as you know, a monthly podcast about the Breakfast Club. Mark.
I know intimately
because
about the LABC.
You also do work on the monthly Los Angeles Breakfast Club podcast.
I am honored to be the announcer for the LABC on the air.
You are.
Wow.
And you do a wonderful job. You add something very special to it each month, as I knew you would, and we appreciate it. And I only wish that some of the long-standing members of the club could learn to click on the link and hit play. Yeah, but the combination of those instructions is beyond the grasp. Technology can be a scary thing. Yeah.
It needs to be an app.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have, for example, one member who showed that he was able to subscribe to it on his phone and then needed my help in trying to figure out how to listen to it. So.
Wait till you try to get him to rate you on iTunes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
The first step of listening to it is go buy a smoking jacket. Anyway. So why no more succotash? 7 years is a long time.
But you got to you got us to 40% market share.
Yeah, it's 11. It's not 11 years like some people I know. But it I just felt like it kind of had its run. I literally cannot keep up with the crush of shows going on now. There's over 350,000 podcasts out there.
Good
and I was, you know, what I like to do is I like to, you know, find new shows and play them. And with the help of Tyson Sainer, my associate producer, we would harvest 8 to 10 shows a week and play these clips. And it was just becoming sort of overwhelming to keep up. We would go after shows that we'd found out had been on and had ended by the time we got them. they'd do like 8 episodes and go, we can't keep this up. And they'd quit. And
oh, my God.
It's like...
Well, that's actually
that's a lot of comics. That's a lot of comedians.
That's actually not a bad show idea, though. A whole podcast dedicated to podcasts that don't exist anymore.
Well, I did for a while have a segment on my show called The Podcast Graveyard, where I would find shows that had been off of podcast for at least a year, and I would clip those episodes.
Right.
And I had like a spooky sound effect, like they were being raised from the grave. I'm not leaving podcasting / soundcasting. I will be back. I'm working to formulate some new ideas. Bill Haywatt and I have an idea we may bring back as a narrative.
But I heard you were dying. That's not true.
No, not at, well. We're all dying. We are all dying.
Yeah, but
I'm going in for an operation.
I'm dying. Yeah. I'm dying last, gentlemen. I'm dying last.
but I have had people that are friends of the show, that have said, why are you leaving? Why? This is great. We love your show, which is great. I love that. But it's just been hard to do. I mean, I was talking on the phone today with frequent guest and friend of the show, Dana Carvey. And he said, I heard you were stopping to do it. Why are you not doing it anymore? I said, I'm just kind of tired of doing it. He goes, oh, okay.
Well, that I get.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, no, okay. I can understand. Why what was your favorite part of doing the show?
I have to say it really was getting to know and network with other podcasters. I mean, that really was the chief audience for my show when it came right down to it. You know, I thought it was going to be like this Whitman sampler as a way for people to kind of dip in and find new shows to go listen to. And I think it was, but the people I heard from most were fellow podcasters like you guys, people over in England, people in Australia. I had a woman who had a podcast in Peru contact me, and I would go to I've gone to the podcast festival for the last 5 years, the LA Podcast Festival. And it was amazing. The people there actually knew who I was. You're that guy.
The aggregate.
Real quick, can you tell the story? You may have already told it on our show, but it's so good. The T.J. Miller story about being at PodFest and when you were first trying to really break the term soundcast big, when you were really really pushing it.
Do I know this story?
Maybe
I don't
not.
Know if I know this one,
maybe not.
I don't know.
This was last year at the LA Pod or the year before the LA Podcast Festival. I was set up in the podcast lab, and I'm sitting there in my little spot on the corner. And once in a while, some name would come through and just sort of do a circuit of all the podcasters sitting there. And there were probably 8 of us all set up around this big table. It was like really hard to have a conversation because everyone else's conversation was bleeding into your conversation. But TJ Miller comes in at one point. And he sees me and he goes, oh, you're that soundcast guy. Yeah, well, I'm not talking to you.
What?
And he just breezes by the chair and the microphone that I have set up there for guests. And he goes to the very next podcast and he sits down and he spends the entire interview talking about Mark Hirschhorn, that soundcast guy. Over there. I'm not talking to him. So he was plugging me on everyone else's podcast that he was interviewing for, but he would not sit down and talk to me, which was hilarious.
Right.
And at the end, he just sort of leaves the room. So he's talked to 8 other podcasts. podcasters. And, you know, he does this great show with Cash Levy, where he, Cash Levy is, it's called Cashing In with T.J. Miller. And the gimmick right. is that Cash Levy is going to interview these, you know, celebrities, and no one ever shows up. And so he has to have T.J. Miller fill in. So every show, and so Cash comes in, who I know, because Cash used to be in San Francisco doing comedy. And he goes, right. you know, that was just a bit, right? I go, yeah, I know it was just a bit. It was fun. But it was just really funny because you could hear him as I was interviewing other people saying, I'm not talking to Mark Hirschhorn with that sound cast.
That's pretty funny, actually. Because that got you into nine other shows that otherwise would never hurt you.
No, I loved it. I loved it. And it's funny because he's you know, retweeted all my stuff. And so he knows who I am. And it's just his style as I've come to know him that's the best way he knew to actually get me more listeners than he could have had being on my show.
Well, that's true. How nice of him. Refreshing.
So having done the Breakfast Club podcast for a year, which so much of which is cutting together clips, I have gotten a sense of what putting together Succotash must have been like for you. And it's a lot of the work is really kind of lonely. You know, you can enjoy the show afterwards, but it's not like this where it's all just talking to somebody.
Chattity-chattity.
No.
You know, which is very hard to grow tired of. I mean, I really thought when we got to 10 years, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. 10 years, that sounds right.
Right.
And I always wanted to get to at least 500. 500 was a good number, but then 10, we've gotten to 500. We at least got to get to 10 years. I mean, that's a big deal.
Right.
It's the Roman numeral X, which Dean continues to be associated with. So that's a good one there. And then we just kept going. And it was like, I don't know. Right. Why not? What the hell else would I do with my Sunday night or Monday morning? I mean.
Well, exactly. And because we're on two different time zones now, that makes it even easier.
Yeah. And Lily said, you know what? You're a lot easier to be around when you do this weekly podcast. When you're able to vent. You're able to get stuff out. So it's. But doing the Breakfast Club podcast, like doing Succotash, a lot of it is just you're alone working by yourself.
You're listening and
trying to find you're trying to go, okay, where's a good in for this clip? How do I get out of it? I don't want it to go too long. It's interesting, and it is actually it's fun for me to listen back to because I only hear it kind of in bits and pieces as I'm assembling it, and I never kind of listen to it in its entirety till I've actually uploaded it. And probably in the 7 years of the show, I've had to go back up five or six times and sort of drop in a new version of the episode because I go, oh, I did something wrong, and there's like 30 seconds of dead air.
Oh, yeah, I think there's one episode I left an hour of dead air after we ended. I was like...
Oh, my goodness. You should have just said that dead air, and you should have made up the name of the podcast.
Yes, called Dead Air. Dead Air.
That's T.J. Miller's new podcast, Dead Air.
Dead Air. Hey, look at that.
It's a spinoff from Fresh Air.
Your sponsor, we're sponsored by the very real, the very phony sounding and very real Empire State Gas, the largest independently owned gas station chain in the Northeast United States. Sure, their gas costs a bit more, but they pass those profits on to their shareholders.
I just filled up yesterday from them because they now have they now deliver via Amazon, which is fantastic.
That is fantastic.
Drone delivery.
I got a big jug of their gas. And
Oh, Empire State Gas. They've got great gas.
We deliver.
But your show was sponsored by a very not real sponsor, Henderson Pants.
Henderson Pants.
What year was Henderson's Pants? What year was Henderson's Pants established?
It was established in 1934, 1792, 857 AD.
Every episode, it was a different establishment date.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's established a different year every time. Absolutely.
Do you have any favorite Henderson pants?
I love the Henderson's pants. Bill Haywatt was the voice of our sponsor and also our booth announcer, and he voiced almost all of them. I read a couple of them just because he either wasn't available or I just wanted to kind of do them on my own. And I wrote them all, with the exception of there's a comedian in New York who wrote me one time and said, "I love the Henderson's pants ads. Can I write a few of them?" So he actually submitted several, which we then recorded, which was great. But yeah, I think my favorite, and it always pops. There's two of them. One of them was one of the very first ones, which was, turtleneck slacks. and they were designed for plumbers and other people that have trouble kind of keeping their crack in the pants.
Right. A turtleneck. Good thinking.
And then there was picnic pants. And picnic pants are, they're red and white checked and quite voluminous, and when you find your picnic spot, they unfurl to create a blanket to sit on, and you carry your burgers and weenies in the meat drawer right up front where you keep your meat, and there was a bun basket in the back where you would carry the buns, and then plenty of room in your pockets for condiments and utensils.
Fantastic! That sounds genius.
Oh my goodness. I wish you'd done down under pants.
Down underpants.
Yeah.
Underpants.
You know what? I've got my final episode coming up, and I am going to have a clip from Chilpak in there, but I think down underpants. I have to get Bill Haywatt to the studio one more time. Oh, and that's a great idea.
With goose down. They're my goose down underpants.
I love it, and even the men's fly opens on the other side.
That's right, so you can watch it drain the other direction.
drain the lizard in the other direction.
Your money is going, and they really only last one wear. So you're losing your money. You're watching your money go down the drain in the opposite direction.
Don't fool yourself. Every pair of Henderson's pants only lasts one wearing. They're the worst pants in the world.
All right.
I'll also miss, one of the regular features we had was our Burst O' Durst with Will Durst. Political comedian from San Francisco. And I mean, he puts these things out, and he has an article that he sends out to about 20 newspapers every week. And then he records these things for a handful of radio stations, but he does a special, cut for Succotash, with a lead in, lead out, and that sort of thing. And he's done that for almost the entire time we've been on the podcast, Podwaves. And so I will miss being able to feature Will, because he's been a great contributor to the show.
Wow. And he was doing that just specifically for Succotash?
Yeah. It was great.
Oh, that's really cool.
2-minute piece. Yeah, it was great.
Well, I mean, it might have been another Succotash that he was doing it for, but conveniently, Hirshon had a show called that. So,
believe me, I know as a branding expert, no one in their right mind would name a show Succotash. It's hard to spell. No one knows what it is. And it's just a bad name for a show. But I did it because I didn't care. But, people were always asking me for advice at these conventions. Hey, how do I get started? What do I do? Blah, blah. I said, first of all, name your show something people can say, spell, and understand. Second of all, release your show the same day every week, which I have never done in 7 years.
Yeah.
Unlike you guys are regular as clockwork. I think you maybe missed a handful of times the entire time you guys have been on.
Right.
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing that way, but I hand it all to Phil on that one. I'm running around the globe.
It has been a little more like clockwork, interestingly enough, with Dean halfway around the world, because although our recording time will change, it always seemed to get pushed back when we were in person. We never really thought it was aimed for like a Monday morning recording, have the show up by Monday afternoon. But then if something came up, we would push it back. Now what happens is if we do it at some time, his Monday, my Sunday, have it out 9 a.m. Pacific time. But if something's coming up, we move it forward. So the recording time may still be variable, but that way the release time is the same. So it's interesting that it's played that way.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.